Welcome to Ripstop on the Record, the podcast for makers, by makers, where we talk about all things MYOG. Brought to you by Ripstop by the Roll.
I think it's good, right?
Yeah, I think that was a good take.
Hey everyone, welcome to Ripstop on the Record. I'm Jameson.
And I'm Avery.
On this episode, we are talking with Chell Lindgren. Now, if that name doesn't mean anything to you yet, it will very soon. This is a really unique episode, and we don't say that lightly. Today we are talking with someone who's a DIYer, but a DIYer that has orbited the Earth for 6 months. Today we're talking with a real-life astronaut who also happens to be a huge fan of the podcast and a maker himself. So we talk about what he did on the space station or in the space station and also how he DIYs and what that means to him.
Yeah. And speaking of Earth Day, happy Earth Day. We have a lot of rad eco fabrics that we sell here at Ripstop by the Roll, from EcoPack to XPack RX to our own eco line like Venom Ultralight Stretch Mesh, Eco Hyper D Eco, Eco Sil Poly, Eco Ripstop. We have a lot of different eco fabrics to choose from. So in honor of Earth Day, we wanted to shout those out and remind you that we're trying to make more eco options available to the market.
Absolutely. Also, another little product teaser here. We will be releasing new colored components soon. So as you've seen over the last several months, we've released colored zipper tape, colored zipper sliders, as well as colored Duraflex components. Very soon, we will be releasing colored Wujin components. So those things include the cross buckle, cord lock, dragon tensioner, G-hook, some stuff like that. So I want to say there's six or seven components that will be getting a color overhaul. So keep your eye on for those, and we're going to do a huge component sale to come as well. So keep an eye out if you want to stock up on some of those new colors. So without further ado, let's get on to the podcast. Hey, Chell, thanks so much for coming on to the podcast today.
Jameson, Avery, really excited to join you today.
So there's a lot of things that we want to talk about. There's a lot of things on this outline, but first I want to talk about you as a maker. How did you get started with sewing and making your own gear?
Yeah, you know, I was a Boy Scout when I was young. I'm an assistant scoutmaster for my son's troops now. I was in the Air Force, and so over the course of time, I collect a lot of patches, and I think becoming very frustrated with having to wait for somebody to put patches onto my uniforms and those sorts of things. I think that's when I initially figured out how to use a sewing machine. I asked my wife actually to teach me how to use hers so that I could put patches onto my uniforms and onto my son's scout uniforms. And I think that is kind of the sewing machine piece. It actually goes back a little bit further. When I was in elementary school, I actually grew up in an Air Force family. We lived in England. I grew up in the DOD, the Department of Defense school system. And I remember, I think it was about fourth, fifth grade, we had these mini courses. And so I took a mini course in bike repair and a mini course in calligraphy and a mini course in sewing. And this was hand sewing. But just really kind of the breaking down of those barriers of this is how you do something like calligraphy, or this is how you would do something like sewing. That came in very handy, learning how to just hand sew. And throughout my life, whether it was in scouts or even in medicine, you know, I developed this eye-hand coordination to be able to sew. I think that obstacle of repairing things yourself or making things yourself, I actually learned a little bit of that in my space station training. So we have a training flow called the on-orbit maintenance flow. And when you're on the space station, if something breaks, we are fixing it. You know, we can't call a mechanic. We have an amazing team that can provide a procedure, point us towards the tools, but we are the ones that are responsible for fixing those things. And so just that empowerment of hey, you can fix this, you can do this, it really spread into my life. And so when our washing machine broke, you know, we found a YouTube video and I got a new control board and put it in there. My car broke and I put in a new brake accumulator, things that I would never have dreamed of doing before. I think there was something about going through my space station training flow that really kind of broke through and gave me this sense of empowerment. Like, hey, just buy the part, find the instructions, and you can make this work. And so that kind of, I think, was part of what inspired me to make my own gear. Again, my sons are scouts. We were training for a big hike, a big backpacking trip, Philmont. And I was faced with not just buying gear for myself, but also for my two boys. And that's a lot of gear. And so there was some gear that clearly was a little bit outside of my ability to create, but there were some things like a backpack rain cover, small ditty bags. Those are things that were really expensive, but I felt like I could make. And so I started looking around online for resources, for materials. And that's when I think I really caught the bug for actually making gear.
Wow. Well, I mean, you kind of spilled the beans a little bit on who you are when you're not making gear, but you dropped some hints in there. So Shell, what do you do? What's your day job?
So I have the privilege of being a NASA astronaut. I joined NASA back in 2007 as a flight surgeon, as a physician. But within a couple of years, NASA announced a new selection. And so I threw my hat in the ring and had the great honor and luck of being selected into the astronaut office. So I've gotten to fly twice. I flew on a Russian Soyuz rocket back in 2015. I spent 141 days on the space station, got to do two spacewalks. And then after coming home, was reassigned to another mission back in 2022 and launched as the commander of Crew 4. We flew a SpaceX Crew Dragon, the Dragon Freedom, and spent 170 days on the space station. I came home a little over a year ago. So absolutely amazing experiences, incredibly grateful for those opportunities, and also very happy to be home on the ground with my family.
Awesome. We're excited to explore the your kind of mindset of being an astronaut and also being a DIYer. So we have a lot of great questions lined up for you that people might have not thought of when we said that we were going to talk to you, someone who's been in outer space. Awesome. So, yeah.
So we had this question written down, Shell, to ask you sort of ways that your maker's mindset has helped you in space. But I kind of feel like you answered that a little bit. So I might flip it as the first question to ask, in what ways has being to space and having to have been the primary person to fix things when there's not just a maintenance person you can call to your house, how has that influenced your making?
Oh, that's interesting. You know, being on the space station, you really have to adopt a specific mindset and recognize that you're a part of a larger team. And, you know, we as the crew have this incredible privilege of being the eyes and hands and ears of the operators on the ground, the flight controllers, the scientists and researchers, the principal investigators whose payloads and science that we're doing. And you really have to kind of own that role. And so when we run into a problem or when we're running an experiment, just recognizing that the folks on the ground don't have the same perspective as we do. And so offering up like, hey, I see this issue, or this is broken, and here are some things that I think that we can do. So really being solution oriented and incorporating your knowledge of your environment, the tools that you have, the skills that you think that you can bring to the table and provide solutions to these problems that you're encountering. And I think that has influenced kind of my DIY mindset on the ground as well. When I run into issues or problems, or I see opportunities, I kind of think about, hey, making this thing would be really helpful here, or I could adjust this piece of gear to do this, or I have this set of gear that I would really like to put into a kit. I don't see that solution in the world, so I'm going to make something specifically to house this specific set of gear. And so I think it's been very empowering to have a perspective that is pushing you to look for solutions and to understand what you can bring to the table to create those solutions.
Do you think that you are more willing than other than other people that might have not honed this skill to kind of go out and try projects that you'd MIOG? I mean, a lot of people look at backpacks and tents and kind of, it's a lot and it can be overwhelming. So they can just kind of say, this is too much. I want to take a step back. Do you feel like your job, day job, is kind of funny because you spent days and nights and everything in between, but like do you feel like your job has helped hone that skill to kind of look at a really big overwhelming project and say, let me figure out how to make this into bite-sized pieces?
I think that it has given me perspective and maybe a predisposition, but I, especially when you look across the maker and the DIY community, the folks that are adding patterns and instructions to forums and all those sorts of things. I mean, there is an amazing community out there, and I'm just grateful to be a part of it. So I think in my own circumstance, the experiences that I've had have kind of pushed me in this direction, but it's clear that there are so many just really talented folks in this domain that are just enriching the experience for everybody else. So I'm certainly grateful to have had the experiences that I've had and to be able to use them to make fun things for family and friends.
So we're going to get to some more of your making and stuff a bit later, but I do want to ask you a little bit about space and what it's like to be up there and what you do. So for the first question they have is, did you get to do any DIYing or MIOGing while you were in the space station?
Well, space is amazing. It's really almost indescribable. You know, getting to do that, getting to have that experience really feels like a once in a lifetime opportunity. And so for me to get it to do it a second time is just really a gift. And so many things about it are amazing. The fulfillment of this lifelong dream, the opportunity to see the Earth from that perspective, to look out a window and to see the Earth with your own eyes, to get to do a spacewalk and to see the outside of the space station and to see, to have that view of the external part of the space station and the Earth just completely fill your field of view and the helmet, the opportunity to float are all incredible. But space is also challenging. I think what we present in video is nicely edited, so it looks for the most part fairly glamorous. Space is a lot like camping. So we sleep in sleeping bags. It's pretty uncomfortable initially as our bodies are adjusting to the weightlessness and they're just undergoing interesting changes as fluid is shifting, as we're getting used to floating and our brains are trying to adjust to the absence of gravity. Many of us feel sick, feel ill, kind of like motion sickness for the first couple of days. There's no what you would call running water. So we recycle all of our water. The air conditioners, produce a condensate that gets processed into drinkable water. Our urine is collected, processed through a urine processor, goes into a water processing assembly, and then becomes drinkable water. And so that just gets dispensed in little bags, kind of like this. So this is a kind of an aluminized bag, and this is our drinking bag. And so when we bathe, we actually will just kind of do towel baths, and we'll dispense hot water into a bag that contains a towel and a little bit of soap, and then open that up, and that's what we'll bathe with. Food is is essentially what we're used to drinking or eating on the trail. It is half of it's dehydrated, the other half is prepared ahead of time and then either thermostabilized, so exposed to very high heat, or irradiated to kill off bacteria to make it shelf stable. And then we just warm that up and eat it. So there are a lot of similarities to camping. That being said, you find opportunities where, again, you can influence for better. And especially now, this being my second mission, I adapted much more quickly. And there were opportunities to do things, to have insights on how we could do things better or maybe make things that could help. So I did end up taking a couple of stowage is a real issue up there. Losing things is a real issue. Just floating, as amazing as it is incredibly challenging. And so one of the most difficult tasks you can have that is incredibly easy on the ground is to be asked to, like, I don't think we have a bag here, but if you just have a bag of stuff and say, hey, we want you to count the number of things in this bag. Here on the ground, we would just open that up, dump it out on the table, run through it, put it in the back in the bag, and you're done. On orbit, every time you open a bag, something immediately wants to float out. And so going through a bag and counting a bunch of small things is just incredibly painful, because you got to lay out, like we'll take gray tape and lay it out, kind of loop it over, or you might find a surface that has Velcro or bungees on it, and you've got to take everything out and very intentionally and carefully put it down on a table so it doesn't float away. Count things up. And as you're doing that, things want to float out of the bag as you're carefully setting everything out. And so you start learning some little tricks as you're doing that. You might, instead of counting everything, you might just take a quick photo and then send that down to the team and ask them to help you do the count. But we had some spare bags that no longer, the contents were gone. And I wanted something that could, I don't even remember, I think it was to hold some of our food items. And so I found a foam piece of board that was left over from a cargo vehicle. I took these bags, I punched holes through the bags, and then used zip ties to kind of clamp secure the bags on this foam. And then I put Velcro on the back of the foam so that we could just put it on the wall. And so there's silly little things like that that you can do. We do have a sewing kit up there, but I don't think that I ever came or needed to use that. So, but there are things like that. And then we have geniuses that go on orbit. Don Pettit is one of our astronauts. He's going to be flying again here soon. He created essentially a barn door equatorial mount for one of our for the camera, so that he figured out all of the physics so that as the space station was flying, this thing would rotate to keep the view of the Earth still as it was rotating underneath us. And he just made it out of things that we had on orbit. It's absolutely amazing. And I can't wait to see what he creates during his next flight.
You mentioned during that you have a sewing kit on the space station. So I am curious, what happens if you have a clothing failure in space? I mean, it seems like you haven't maybe used that sewing kit, but if you do have a clothing failure in space, how have you fixed it in the past?
Sure. Yeah, you could definitely use the sewing kit, I think, for a clothing failure on orbit. Our clothing, so one of the drawbacks of having restricted water is that we don't wash our clothes. And so what that means is that we probably wear them a little bit longer than you would wear them in between washes on the ground. And then when we're done, so during my first mission, I was issued, I think, 4 pairs of pants.
Okay.
2 didn't fit, 1 I didn't like. And so I wore one pair of pants for 6 months. Now I'm going to tell you what we're going to say is that, clothes wear a little bit differently on orbit. They don't hang on you. So they kind of float around you a little bit. And so you don't this is at least what we're telling ourselves. You don't transfer the oils and the dirt and all of that stuff so that you could wear a pair of pants for 6 months. Nobody ever commented to me during my first mission. During my second mission, I made sure that I had a larger array of wardrobe. But in the end, for like t-shirts, especially the things that we're wearing when we work out, we have a usage rate. And so we get issued, I think it's 2 workout shirts every week, every 2 weeks, 1 pair of shorts, several pairs of socks. So like for a workout shirt, you're wearing that for about a week before you ultimately throw it away. Mm. And for shorts, you're wearing that for 2 weeks before you throw it away. Like a standard kind of workday t-shirt, you're wearing for about a week or 2. Underwear, you're wearing, I think, 3 or 4 days. Because, you know, frontward, backward, inside out, and then front. But we do have a usage rate, and so we aren't able to really wash clothes up there. And so they end up, once we're done with them, we roll them up, put them in the trash, and they get disposed of.
Okay. Wow. As you were saying that, I was thinking, man, your clothes probably don't get that dirty anyways. I mean, if you spill something on yourself, it's not going to stay there. Like all the dirt and debris kind of flying around you. So I was just thinking too about like socks, like pet hair. Well, you guys don't have any pets. And if there's hair, it's not sticking to the bottom of your socks. So
socks are a whole nother thing. I don't want to gross everybody out, but one of the physical changes that happens while you're floating in space is that you're not standing on your feet. You're not compressing the skin of your feet. And so over the course of 6 months, that all of that thick foot skin, all of that callus sloughs off. So that by the time you get home, your feet are like baby soft. And my wife often will make fun of me like that's a long road to get like a pedicure. But all that foot skin sloughs off, and that sloughs off over the time that you're in space. So that when you take your socks off, if you're not careful, you can create this just shower of foot skin everywhere. And so we are very intentional about teaching our crewmates that are coming on orbit that, hey, over time, you just need to be careful about how you take your socks off, because it can create this gross cloud of foot skin that just flies everywhere. And like, you're not being a good crewmate if you're creating a cloud of foot skin for your other crewmates to like breathe in and, you know, whatever. So we have good ventilation systems. They pull most of that hair and skin and dust into filters that we clean every week. But those are one of your things. So you don't take the top of your sock and just kind of fling your socks off. You know, when you're getting ready to do your bath, you'll kind of take the sock at the top of your calf and then just kind of shimmy it down slowly and capture all that skin in there and tie it in a knot and put that in the trash. So stuff you never knew about about living yeah. in space. See, not there are definitely the non-glamorous parts of being up there.
Yeah, every time we get the chance to talk to you, I'm learning something new. I'm still reveling over that you have to drink your own pee, but everyone else has to also drink your own pee and everyone else's pee. So like that's been right. My fun fact since we saw you in person. It's just telling everyone I know that you have to drink other people's pee. Unrelated to that.
Well, let's be clear. I mean, this is recycled. Okay. This is it does. So it takes it takes a little while to get used to the idea that you're drinking your recycled urine. But like you said, it takes even longer to get used to the idea that you're drinking everybody else's recycled urine.
I do have a follow up. We're going to go down this pee water tangent real quick. But is it like, you know, there is like Brita filtered water taste, and there's like tap water taste. It's like, you know, mountain stream through your Sawyer squeeze or your Ketadine pee filter. What's the taste? What's the flavor like of this water, this recycled pee?
So the water is actually it's really good. I think it tastes better than the water that comes out of the taps here in the city. And my understanding is that they actually had to add some minerals back to it because it is so clean that it tastes weird without having a little bit of kind of mineral content like that we would normally have in our water. And just to be clear, the reason that we recycle our water is because we're using the space station as a platform for future exploration. And so our goal, the reason that we live and work in space, the reason that we've been in low Earth orbit since the year 2000 with people living and working in space for over 23 years, is to extend our presence in the solar system and to make life better back here on Earth. And so as we think about going to the moon, as we reach for Mars, we can't carry tons and tons of water with us. And so we have to figure out how do we recycle the water so that we don't need 2 liters of water per person every day for an entire crew. And so using the space station as a platform to figure out how to do this, we've gone from about 93% reclamation to now about 98%. And so that's really empowering our future exploration, but it's also having impact on Earth. So this technology that we've developed, we can share with folks on the Earth. We know that there are places that don't have access to clean water. And so this technology can be leveraged for good back on the Earth as well.
Nice. I feel like that's a technology that, man, could be applied in various parts of the world. But another thing I'm really curious about, just because I love clothes and I love fashion, are these spacesuits you're wearing. Are you allowed to talk about them? Can you share some facts? Oh, I'm not sure how far you can go into that, but yeah, I mean, the material is interesting, how they kind of work, or even how much they weigh. I would love to know that information.
Sure. So we've got, when we think about spacesuits, we really have two major classes of spacesuits that when we talk about. So there is that white iconic spacesuit that that we wear when we're doing spacewalks. It is, when you think about an astronaut, at least when I thought about astronauts, you really think about that classic white spacesuit. There's also another, what we'll call a spacesuit, that's a launch and entry suit. So that launch and entry suit, for the Russians, we call it a Sokol suit. And it's kind of a white with blue straps, a helmet, that kind of a soft back, but a plexiglass or polycarbonate arc that comes over the front of and locks in. In the space shuttle, it was an orange, called an ACES. It was an orange suit. And then when I flew on the Dragon, it was a very kind of futuristic looking white and gray and gray suit. So the purpose of that suit is purely that if there is an emergency, if for some reason the spacecraft depressurizes or there's a toxic atmosphere, we have a suit that is protecting us. And unfortunately, those were hard-won lessons. We had a Russian crew perish as a result of a vehicle depressurization. And that is really what spurred their community to require their cosmonauts to wear pressure suits in the vehicle. In the shuttle experience, our space shuttle astronauts used to launch just in flight suits. So kind of the blue flight suit that you'll often see our crew members wearing. But after the Challenger accident, because there was some indication that, not in that particular accident, but some indication that the crew could survive just a depressurization, they need the tools and equipment to be able to survive in that depressurized or those conditions. And so having a protective suit is valuable. But let's step back. Let's talk about that, the white, what we could describe as the EMU. It's the extravehicular mobility unit. We practice in that suit in the pool. I got to wear that suit during two spacewalks, and it is a marvel of modern engineering. It is a miniature spacecraft. So there are no hoses that connect the suit to the spacecraft to provide oxygen or water or gas. It is all self-contained in that spacesuit. So it is really a miniature spacecraft. And the materials that go in to create that. So this is a suit that has to hold an atmospheric pressure. And so it holds about 4.3 PSI, pounds per square inch of pressure. Wow. So mean sea level pressure is about 14.7. And so this has a reduced pressure. And in order for us to have a breathable atmosphere, it's at 100% oxygen. And so there's a compromise there. 100% oxygen allows us to get the amount of oxygen that we need to live and work. And then by decreasing the pressure, you know, the suit is inflated to a point where we can still move around. If the suit was inflated to 14.7 PSI, we would just be kind of like this and really kind of unable to move. So we figured out kind of the compromises to be able to provide a suit that provides us with air to breathe and yet it is soft enough for us to still be able to do meaningful work. It protects us from temperature extremes. So when you're in the sun, it's upwards of 250 degrees Fahrenheit. And when you're in the shade, it's minus 250 degrees Fahrenheit. So the suit has to be able to protect you from those temperature extremes and to deal with being even partially in the sun and partially in the shade. It also serves as a micrometeorite garment. And so that is, there are small pieces of debris, just flecks of paint, something the size of a piece of sand, traveling at 17,500 miles per hour or greater. And so we see the effects that that debris has when it hits the space station. You know, in some of our windows, kind of like your windshield on your car, when it gets hit by a little piece of gravel, it has a little bit of a fleck in the windshield. We see those impacts on the windows of the space station. We see the effects of those impacts on the outside of the space station. And so if one of those were to hit us while we were doing a spacewalk, it could be catastrophic. And so the suit is built to provide us with some protection in that manner. And so I actually have a little our engineers put together just kind of a little sample pack of the materials that go into the layers of our spacesuit. And so this outer piece, I think, is called like an orthogarment. It is made up of Kevlar, Teflon, and what is the other piece of that? Oh, Nomex. So this is a very tough, and it's supposed to be protective against those micrometeorite strikes. It also is white, and so that helps to reflect a lot of that sunlight and heat and provides us some of that thermal protection. And so altogether, this is described as a TMG, or thermomicrometeorite garment. Below that, we've got some aluminized mylar, several sheets of aluminized mylar. I think that's helping with some of the thermal protection. Or we have a neoprene-coated nylon ripstop. Below that, we've got a Dacron pressure restraint. So when we inflate the suit, this prevents it from ballooning out. And so you can, just like you all do with your samples, there's very little stretch in this, especially in kind of the warp and weft directions, maybe a little bit on the bias. And then closer to the skin is our bladder. And so this is a urethane-coated nylon ripstop, and this is really what is keeping the atmosphere in the suit. And then below that, some spandex and kind of a mesh, and it's the spandex and mesh that make up our LCVG. And so this is the liquid cooling ventilation garment, and I don't think we've got a sample of that, but it is essentially our long underwear, and it has essentially kind of IV tubing running through that garment. And that is how we provide cooling and temperature control to the crew member. So we have these tubes running all over our body that plugs into our suit, and we're able to meter the amount of cold water that is basically going over the top of our body. And that helps to control, essentially, we can set that to maintain temperature within the suit. So all of these things taken together make for a very kind of thick outer layer of the suit. And the suit altogether weighs about 250, 300 pounds. So definitely not made for walking around on Earth. I can barely stand up in it. I can take a couple of steps, but that's not what it's made for. That suit is made for floating around in space. And so this is a really amazing time in human spaceflight as we mature from, again, doing operations and weightlessness to thinking about doing exploration on a lunar surface. And we are in the process of working with partners to build a new suit to actually wear on the lunar surface. And so it's going to have many similarities in terms of how it's made, but it is going to have, you know, soles on the bottom of the feet, because you're going to be walking on a surface. And all those things taken together then produce something like this. So this is one of our space suit gloves. You can kind of see the urethane bladder inside, but the craftsmanship that goes into creating like the fingers, and I can't take this piece off, but this is just kind of a cover, but just the intricacies of how the gloves are formed and sewed is just absolutely mind-blowing. And so we're very lucky to have the incredible engineers and fabricators that put these spacesuits together for us.
I'm going to ask a question, and I might have to cut it out. But do you have an in-person team at NASA that is sewing and doing this, or is it done somewhere else?
So a lot of that fabrication is done. The suits are made by one of our partners, our commercial partners. And so we kind of list the specifications, and then it is those teams that go off and actually create the suits. And there's a really, we may need to cut this out, but there's a very interesting story about the teams that we engaged to create the very first spacesuits, because you needed that skill of creating garments to be able to produce these. And so the company that ultimately, I think, won the very first spacesuit contracts were companies that made women's clothing, specifically like bras and those sorts of things, just because of the intricate sewing that needed to be done.
Absolutely. That makes sense. I was just curious, you know, there's every day I think of, oh, I've never thought about that job. That's, you know, that would be a new job for me. But now it's like dream job. So gear for astronauts that you get to wear, that would be really incredible and also a high level of risk and high level of reward. I'm sure there are quality effects through and through, but that would be a really, a really cool job to have.
And in fact, you know, we work in the suits in the neutral buoyancy laboratory. This is a 6 million gallon pool, 40 feet deep, contains a replica of the space station, so that we practice how to interact with the suit, how to move, how to use tools. It is probably the 80% solution for being able to do a spacewalk. So we could not be successful in doing a spacewalk without the neutral buoyancy laboratory. But even given all that practice, we have, as a part of our training flow, especially leading up to our first spacewalk, we will do something called a SATA run. And I don't know what that stands. I don't remember what that stands for. We love our acronyms, but it is, they put us into a, in the suit, into a vacuum chamber, and will take us down to a vacuum. And so we're, it's about a 4 hour evolution. We get to do some fun things in there. Like we'll take a, like they give us a feather and I don't remember a book or something. And we get to drop that in the chamber and see them hit the ground at the same time, because you don't have the effect of air resistance in there, but it gives us that confidence of, hey, this is a suit that is going to take care of me in the vacuum of space. This is what it's going to feel like and sound like and smell like. And so that's a great confidence boost as we're preparing for our missions.
So you just showed us a lot of these layers of the spacesuit, and I'm kind of interested about what other materials and fabrics that you have or that you've used that would be really interesting to tell us about, or that we could, or maybe there's one out there where you're like, man, I kind of wish Rips Up By The Rule could make this so that we could have this in backpacking material one day. Or what sort of crazy materials do we not get to see kind of in the general market that you think would be really interesting for that you get to see in space or through NASA?
You know, I think a lot of the materials that are on the market right now are pretty amazing. There are a lot out there right now that are pretty amazing, and just the, they're so incredibly tough and yet light. I know a lot of those are, have been ported over from the sailing industry. I think what a gift to be able to use those in things that we're just using for packs and gear and that sort of thing. You know, I'll just share with you some of the things I told you a little bit earlier about the drink bags that we have on orbit. And so these will look, I think, a lot like kind of a Capri Sun bag. And so depending on what it is that you want to drink. So for me, coffee was very important. And so I had my half sweet coffee with cream, whether or if it's a juice. You basically take this drink bag up to our water dispenser and dispense either hot or cold water, depending on what you want to drink. Excuse me. And when you're drinking coffee, because the ventilation is so good in the space station, once you've filled this up with coffee, it gets cold really quick. And so I had a lot of fun just thinking of ways that I could be an encouragement to my classmates and my crewmates as they were getting ready to fly. And so I used a little bit of my DIY, I wouldn't even call it expertise, but the budding skills to do things, especially when my classmates were first getting their first flights. And so I would make kind of flight scarves for them. Super, super simple, you know, basically sewing straight lines and just ending up with a rectangle of fabric. But I would try to find fabric that represented their call sign or their history or something that they particularly liked over time. But as I was preparing for my second mission and my friends were preparing for their second missions, I thought, hey, you know what would actually be cool is to have something that we could kind of be an insulator for our drink bags so that it would keep our beverages hot for longer. And so then I started making drink bag insulators for my friends and tried to do those in ways that, again, reflected their background and their spaceflight experience. And so as an example, this is a version that I made for one of my friends that flew on the Soyuz. And so this is kind of taking cues from the Russian Soyuz spacesuit, the color and the blue straps and some of the clasps and everything, and then fitting it with Velcro so that we can attach it to the wall in the space station or attach it to ourselves. We've got Velcro on our clothes, And so as you're moving around, you could just stick this to your pant leg as you're translating around the spacecraft. And so one of my friends came from the Army. And so, you know, one side reflects his Soyuz experience and the other side reflects kind of the career he had before he came into the astronaut office. And places, of course, really important places to put patches. And then in contrast, a drink bag insulator that I made for myself reflected my second mission and the SpaceX spacesuit. And so again, adding some Velcro, a place to put a patch. And then the backside is just this kind of a crazy conglomeration of materials and things that are meaningful to me. But again, these are just small ways to do fun things that are an encouragement for our crewmates. And all the feedback I got and my own experience on orbit was having something that insulated our drink bags was really, really handy. So I think this is something that I used every day that my crewmates ended up using every day. And so it was a lot of fun to kind of put these together before our flight. Of interest, a lot of these materials, because we have to pass flammability tests and we're very concerned about flammable items within the spacecraft, I had to choose more cotton. And so the insulation inside is a cotton batting. Materials are largely cotton, just to reduce that cotton or wool to reduce the flammability risk and to make sure that it was getting past our safety inspectors. But so just a little one way that I was using materials in preparation for space flight in a more personal way.
It's funny you bring up wool because I was thinking about that earlier when you were talking about your daily wear t-shirts and shorts and stuff. It made me think about some of the new yarn and the merino poly blend that we see like in the outdoor world of something that will be largely antimicrobial, won't smell bad after a lot of uses. You know, if it can work in the through hiking community, I'd imagine it probably work really well in space too for the smell and the durability maybe.
You know, and that's interesting. I think that the community that does crew provisioning is really looks across the landscape and looks for things that have antimicrobial capability. Because again, we're wearing these shirts for a week or two on end, maybe stain resistance, but have that are not necessarily a lot of synthetics. And we do wear some synthetics on orbit, but we are cautioned they are for exercise only. We're not supposed to be wearing those during kind of the day. And so mainly for our daily wear clothes, it's going to be the more organic materials. But I think we're constantly on the lookout for things that can be leveraged for exploration.
Yeah, no, it makes sense. So you just showed us some of those drink pouches that you made. I'm interested to talk to you more about and also have the listeners hear about other stuff that you've made, whether it's for your space missions or just recreationally for your backpacking trips and for your boys. Tell us about some other stuff that you've been up to, maybe projects you're currently working on or things that you're just proud of that you've made in the past.
Well, there's some great patterns out there and great kits. And I found it really useful just kind of marching through kits that I can find online and that had instructions and to challenge myself with kind of something new each time I was making a kit. And typically I would follow the directions, and that's kind of like how I learned to use zippers for the first time or to do a drawstring, to do French seam, whatever it is. And as I've done many of those now, I think I've made a tarp, I've made a hammock, I've made a porter bag, a running backpack. I'm currently working on a fast pack. And now that I've done a lot of those things, I feel a little more comfortable maybe changing, not exactly following the pattern and doing things like, hey, I think this would work a little bit better. That doesn't always work out. That's part of the fun is, well, if you call seam ripping fun, making mistakes and figuring out how to do it better the next time. And, you know, it actually kind of reminds me a little bit of our spaceflight training. When you look at something like a full up backpacking pack, that just seems like an insurmountable project. And as I looked at our training to prepare, you know, once I was selected in the astronaut office, and you think about where you've got to be in 2 years, trained up on how to do a spacewalk, how to use a robotic arm, how to manage the spacecraft space station systems, both during a routine day and during an emergency, how you fly in our jet, that is an insurmountable amount of work. But I think that NASA does a really good job of just breaking that down into incremental, manageable bites of information and skills development. And so on day one, you're just learning how to turn the computer on. But by, you know, day 500, you can manage the spacecraft when it is maybe out of control and figure out how to take all the systems down and bring it back online to stabilize the spacecraft. So those incremental pieces of learning I find to be just very valuable. And that's kind of where my journey of trying out different kits, different patterns, and taking those skills and building upon them, getting to a point where now I'm trying to actually create a backpacking pack, has just been a lot of fun. And, you know, for example, I talked a little bit about building a kit. My background is actually as a physician. I trained in emergency medicine and then aerospace medicine. And I just wanted to have kind of a first aid trauma kit but I just couldn't find anything on the market that I really liked. And so I decided to just kind of what I actually wanted in the kit and set it out, and then ended up making the kit exactly how I wanted it with the exact things I wanted it and the places where I wanted it. And so it's just being able to take all of the skills that I've learned through other kits of, you know, zippers and making small packs and those sorts of things, to be able to then go on to do something like this, which has been a lot of fun. And my son is currently in his first year at the Air Force Academy. And so it's been a lot of fun just making little gadgets for him as well, to try and make his life a little bit easier.
Chell, you should have told me that you were working on a fast pack or thinking about that when you're in the office, because I've unintentionally made that one of my favorite things to make, and I've made too many of them, honestly.
Oh,
so
really?
We got to bounce some ideas off each other. Yeah.
All right. That's pretty cool. I'm currently working on, so just having listened to your team's wisdom over the past couple of years, and hearing about some of the products on the market, I've, in the pattern that I've had, I've added a pocket, like a bottom pocket, and the side pockets I've altered a little bit, because I didn't feel like at least the pattern I'm working with is the pockets are deep enough. So I'm kind of stepping out a little bit. We'll see how it all turns out, but it's been a lot of fun. It's kind of putting it together. And again, you know, once this is done in the future, I might feel comfortable just kind of making my own thing and seeing how it turns out.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I love that. I'm excited to compare and contrast some notes there.
That'd be great.
So, not long ago, I was going to say a few months ago, probably only a few weeks ago, you had the opportunity to come to Rip Stop of the Roll, and we had the opportunity to talk to you and hang out with you and listen to some things. Yeah. And one of your answers I thought was really, really poignant, and I wanted to talk about it a little bit here, at least have your kind of you recreate your answer a little bit. And I asked you sort of, what sort of perspective have you been able to gain from having this like remarkable position of looking down at the Earth and kind of getting this ridiculous bird's eye view that not many people get the chance to see? What sort of things have you been able to bring back to Earth and back to your own life that have been kind of, what about space has changed your perspective on things? And so I wanted to kind of re-ask you that question and just kind of have you share that answer here back on the podcast again.
Sure. Yeah. Thank you, Jameson. You know, having gotten to float, having gotten to fulfill this lifelong dream, having gotten to be a part of just an absolutely incredible team, just one small cog and an amazing team that's here at Johnson Space Center that spans our country and truly spans the world with our international partners. Haven't gotten to work on hundreds of different scientific projects, haven't gotten to do all those and experienced all those things. I think one of the greatest gifts from that spaceflight experience is, for me, the gift of perspective. It is the perspective of looking on my journey to becoming an astronaut. It was not a straight path. There was a lot of adversity there, and the gift of looking at those challenges on those hard days and recognizing them as gifts that ultimately led to this opportunity is a tremendous blessing to me and a real gift of perspective. The other perspective, and something that I think really changed how I view the Earth is really when you look out from our the cupola, is the 7-bay window that faces down towards the Earth. When you look through the cupola and you see the Earth, and you look to the left of it, to the right of it, above and below, there is nothing else out there. It is the black, inky void of space. And it really just drives home the understanding that the Earth is finite. It is a discrete entity. And it is home for us. There is nothing else out there that within our capability right now, within our understanding, that can sustain life. This is created perfectly for humanity. And living on the space station, it really drives home this concept of, you know, on the space station, this is a vehicle, a spacecraft that is providing with us with air to breathe and food to eat, water to drink. It is providing an atmosphere that is breathable. It's protecting us from the swings of heat and cold, and protecting us from micrometeorite damage. And it is imminently clear that if we don't take care of the space station, if it breaks, we will die. I mean, it is just that clear that this structure is preserving our life in the vacuum of space. And so we spend 30% of our time as crew members doing preventive and corrective maintenance on the space station to preserve it so that it can preserve us. It's really simple calculus. And then I just kind of had this profound realization looking back at the Earth. You know, ultimately, the Earth is humanity's spaceship. It provides us with food to eat, water to drink. It protects us from radiation, from micrometeorites, from the extremes of the vacuum of space. And yet, there are very few of us that spend 30% of our time taking care of this spacecraft, of humanity's spaceship. When we're on the Earth, it feels infinite. You know, there are very few of us that are worried about where our next breath of air is going to come from, where our next drink of water is going to come from. There are those that struggle with that, but for most of us, very gratefully, those are not things that we are concerned about. And so it seems like with that infinite supply that we can just live life with abandon. And I guess the perspective I came back with is that we absolutely need to be better stewards of this spaceship, that the resources are finite, that as we look at the Earth from space, we can see the changes that humanity has on the Earth. And, you know, forest fires in South America and pollution over continents, and much of the change is necessary. Much of what we do is necessary to support our populations. Agriculture, absolutely. But there are things that we can do where we can be more efficient, where we can be more intentional, where we can be better stewards of the resources that we've been given. And so I think that really impacted me from my first mission. It made me want to be a better steward in my own life. And so it really was an encouragement to me as I was am an assistant scoutmaster in my Boy Scout troop to really try to emphasize conservation and outdoor ethics, to become a Leave No Trace trainer, to my wife and I become Texas Master Naturalists, and volunteer at a local nature center, all in an effort to kind of do our small part, to volunteer, to help educate others, to be better stewards of this gift that we've been given, humanity's spaceship, the Earth.
I really appreciate you kind of recounting that feeling that you evoked to us there. It's powerful, I guess, to use both of your things that you mentioned there, the perspective and the environmentalism. It just changed my perspective a little bit, because as someone, I think a lot of people listening have a connection to the outdoors to some extent, where a lot of us are makers, but we do that for some activity, whether hiking, backpacking, or running, or kayaking, or biking, or anything that it is. All of us have a connection to the outdoors. And I think I wanted to talk about that again, just because I do think a lot of people here, I was someone that would say was conscious of like environmentalism and conservation and these things that I think about a lot, but then getting that perspective, I'm like, oh yeah, like the, I don't know, helped having some sort of number, I guess, like the 30%, gave me some sort of concept, like, oh yeah, like that's really interesting. And we don't spend, like, how much time do we spend actually caring for the earth? Like, measuring in that way was interesting. Not as a way to, like, I don't need more reasons to, like, make myself feel bad for things. You know, I can, my mind can do that anyway, but, like, the number gave me something to shoot for, like, oh, cool. Like, maybe this is something that, like, I can use as an example. Do I want to do more trail maintenance, or, you know, just something to kind of start to do more with, and just kind of something to aspire to, I guess, instead of something to be like, well, the earth is dying, that sucks. You know, like, you know, it helped me a little bit. So I appreciate that.
And it feels overwhelming, you know, when we think about the changes that are occurring to the earth, it feels a little overwhelming. Like, what can I as one person do? But as one person, you know, it is amazing what one person can accomplish just in their own lives. And it's amazing what they can do in being an encouragement and an educator, an influencer outwards. And, you know, I think that your experiences, Avery, your experiences, our experiences in the outdoors, this gear, I think, facilitates our ability to be in the outdoors comfortably. And that being on a trail, you are very, very closely connected to the environment, to the outdoors. And I think that certainly gives you an appreciation for what a gift it is to be able to live in an environment where we can get outside, where we can enjoy it, the beauty, the experience of being outside, and hopefully that connection driving a desire to preserve and conserve.
Absolutely. With that being said, I'm also going to say that you're now an honorary thru-hiker. If you wore the same clothes for 6 months in a row, circumference hundreds of millions of times, that's like a really long thru-hike. You're just, instead of, like, you know, hiking north or south, you're just going around the earth. There's a lot of similarities there.
Let's I want to come up with all of those similarities, because that's pretty great. We even I know that you've got a trail name. We even occasionally end up with nicknames for our fellow crew members. So
yes, I was gonna ask that. So we have one final question that we like to wrap up with. What is one fabric that you think is missing on the market? It can be, you know, space related. It could just be in your own DIY NYOG related. But what is one fabric that you think is missing that we could benefit from?
Wow, interesting.
Maybe it's a fabric that you wish we sold that would help your fast pack, or
I know that you all have a triad of price and weight and durability. Is that right? Is that the triad of the materials? And as one adjusts, you know, that affects the others. And I think, you know, there are amazing technical fabrics out there now that are incredibly durable, incredibly light. And I think really finding the sweet spot on price, so being able to have that durability and decreased weight, but being able to make it more affordable. I think that's the ideal. I know that those fabrics are, a lot goes into their construction. You pay a price for having something that where you're minimizing weight and making things incredibly durable. But for me, that would be the dream fabric, is something that is a little more affordable.
Nice. I love that. I think that opens up the accessibility to everyone else as well. And one thing that we hear a lot with, because some of the cooler fabrics are the ones that, you know, cost a little bit more, but when it's more sometimes stronger than steel, there's a price to pay for that.
That's right.
And lastly, I just want to call back to one of the reasons why you initially reached out was that you are a listener to our podcast. Not only are you joining us on, you know, episode 90 plus, getting close to the 100, but you've listened to every single one of our episodes, which I know me and Jameson kind of have a little bit of imposter syndrome. We're like, we're not doing this. So maybe you can relate with being an astronaut. You're like, I can't believe I actually did that. You know what I mean? But we had an episode on tape and how to tape and theme tape your gear. And I guess we threw it out into the universe quite literally when we said, if any of our listeners are astronauts, tell us how you theme tape gear when you have zero gravity. So we didn't know we were putting that out into the universe when we said that 60 episodes ago. But I'm glad that we did. I'm glad that we put it out there. I'm glad that you listened to our episodes, and thank you, because it's not a small feat. Some of them are painful to sit through with the audio problems, but we sure do appreciate it. And we're just so glad that you came into our NYOG world and that it came true. We never knew we'd had an astronaut listener, but we appreciate it. And it's been really great to kind of harvest this relationship with you and get to talk to you, because like, you're an astronaut, but you're just like us. So it's been really fun having you on and learning from you.
Well, thank you, Avery. I really appreciate those kind words. I definitely enjoyed listening to the podcast after I got back from my last mission. And so just thank you to you and Jameson, to the rest of your team, for your investment in this community, for being an encouragement, for educating those of us that are interested in making gear, and just really being kind of a foundation for that activity. So really appreciate you all, and appreciate this opportunity to join you today.
Thank you.
Thanks, Joe.
All right. Take care.